So I'm not sure I'm ready to make a habit of singing in my sermons. But I just couldn't help think of this old hymn when reading through Mark's ending, what Desiree read. You all probably know it. Johnny Cash sang it with the Carter sisters. All right. Sam Cooke. You all know Sam Cooke, right? All right. He did something really weird and strange with it, but it was cool. I listened to it. YouTube. It's amazing what you can find. And then Willie Nelson even recorded it. And by the way, I lived about 30 miles growing up from where Willie Nelson grew up. And so we always drove right past Carl's Corner, which was all Willie Nelson stuff. And it was pretty fantastic. It was like this big old truck stop. But anyways, he has a sort of a close proximity to my heart. Well, I think this hymn actually made it on American Idol once, so you should know it. It's got this range that just gives me fits sometimes, though, so forgive me if I crack some of these. That's how it goes. So, were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Oh, sometimes it causes me to tremble, tremble, tremble. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Oh, too kind. Too kind. If you're one of the characters in Mark's gospel, you'd have to say no, because you weren't there. You weren't. The closest any of Jesus' followers came to being there, Mark says, was looking on from a distance. And don't even mention the disciples. It wasn't them. They were long gone. Were you there? If you didn't make it out to Vicky and Brian's place on Thursday, you should make a plan to be there next year or wherever we have it, because it was great. There was smoked salmon. That was great, unless you're a vegetarian. Then it wasn't great. There were those. Everybody was really forgiving when I completely botched the high point of the Lord's Supper, which is not really something you should do. But I did it. I appreciate that, by the way, all of you. We called it a modern Last Supper, a modern Last Supper, because we tried to recreate the feel of what it would have been like to be in that upper room with Jesus and his 12 disciples the night before he was betrayed. Many of you that know that Sarah, my wife, teaches at a Jewish school, all right, and because of this, she gets invited to a lot of Jewish celebrations. Well, one year she told me of this Passover dinner, and that's exactly what it was, a full-on party. There was so much food, she can't even remember the number of courses they served. If you had to compare it to something, I guess, in the Christian calendar, you'd compare it to Easter, which just makes good sense, all right? But that's the point. The Passover is a time of celebration. It's supposed to be fun and exciting. It's supposed to be this time when everyone is high on life, because they're all remembering how God delivered them from slavery in Egypt, just like we remember how Jesus delivers us from sin and death. But you wouldn't get any of that, none of it, from reading Mark's version of this story. In Mark, the Last Supper is all about how Judas is going to betray Jesus and how everyone else is going to abandon him. Listen to this. It's really quite depressing. Here's what Mark says. After singing a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and Jesus said to them, "You're all going to desert me. Every single one of you, you're all going to abandon me." It's basically inevitable, Jesus says. There's literally nothing they can do about it. He goes on, "You're all going to fall away because that's what the Bible says. It says, 'I will strike you down. I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. But then Peter, and by the way, Peter is always the guy that seems to stick his foot in his mouth. Peter says, "No, Lord, even though everyone else may fall away, I'll never leave you. I'll never leave you." And that's when we get Jesus' famous, "Truly I say to you, Peter, that this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times." If there's a theme in Mark, it's that nobody, and I mean nobody, gets it. Nobody gets it. Not even Jesus' closest followers get it. Not even, it seems, does Jesus' own mother. The only guy that even comes close to getting it is a Roman centurion at the cross who just shows up for this one special moment in Mark's gospel, and he says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." It's like Mark looks around for someone the whole time, actually trying to find somebody who's going to realize that Jesus is the Messiah and that he's going to have to die if the world is going to be saved, but Mark can't find anybody except some random soldier. Everyone else in Mark's story is just long gone. And that's really the theme here. I once heard Mark's gospel called the Gospel of Failure. The Gospel of Failure, which if you're writing a gospel, you probably don't want it to be called that, the Gospel of Failure. But it's a name that fits, I think, all the way to the end even. Just think back to what Desiree read a few minutes ago. And by the way, she read all the way to the end of the book. It just stops right there. So here's Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome. The 12 male disciples have long deserted Jesus altogether, as I mentioned. And here are these three women. They're walking up to where Jesus is buried, and it's really early on Sunday morning after the Sabbath is all done. When I think about them, I get this image in my head that they're crying. They didn't know how any of this could have happened. They didn't know how what they were going to do now. They didn't know where they were going to go, what that would even look like. How would they move on? Here is their Messiah, the anointed one, they thought, the one who was going to finally deliver them from the Romans and make them once and for all a new people. Here is their Ezekiel, the one who was, as he says, going to make these dry old bones live. But all of that had died on Friday. Just died. None of what we just heard, does he say, from Isaiah, none of that promise was true. There would be no feast. There would be no wine. The shadow of death obviously still clung to all of them. And to say that the sovereign Lord was going to wipe away all their tears was just mean. It was this cruel mockery of what they had just gone through. I can only think when I think of them walking up to that tomb, that as they slowly, like just strolled that morning in all the gloom, the wet chill still clinging to their skin, making them shiver and their skin crawl, they couldn't help muttering to themselves, This is our God? This is our Lord? We trusted him? That one? What did we think he was going to do? Save us? He couldn't even save himself. So it only makes sense, I think, when they make it to the tomb, that they expect the stone to still be there. They expected Jesus to still be dead, but the stone's gone. It's gone, and nothing's covering up the tomb. And Jesus isn't in it, and they simply can't believe it because it doesn't make any sense to them. Instead, they find some young guy sitting there, right where Jesus should have been, and he tells them that they shouldn't be amazed. Why are you amazed at any of this? All right? It's as if finding out that someone was raised from the dead was just par for the course or something. All right? Was this young guy mocking them too? Why are you looking so shocked? Don't be. You're looking for Jesus, the one who was crucified, but he's not here anymore. Not here anymore? Well, where in the world did you take him then? Nowhere. He's been raised from the dead, resurrected. Look, they laid him right here on the stone slab, but he's gone. And he wants you. He wants you to do this. He wants you to tell his disciples, and he wants you to especially tell that little denier Peter, tell that one, that he's gone off to Galilee and that you should all just follow him there. Disciples? Galilee? Peter? What is all of this? Resurrection? And then it ends. Right there, the next line, the story just stops. So the three women fled from the tomb, trembling and astonished, and they said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Period. Done. That's it. That's the end of Mark's story. It's the end of his gospel. It's as if somebody accidentally ripped off the last page and left us all with this weird and kind of awkward, half-believable tale of three women who failed to say anything because they were too afraid. I mean, is that really it? Did they just stay afraid? I mean, how could they have? I mean, we have a church. If they just stayed afraid and didn't tell anybody, how did we get here? This doesn't make any sense. For centuries, people haven't thought this made sense. They've sworn that Mark must have had a longer ending because the gospel just can't end like that. It can't end in failure. They even wrote up a couple of different endings and slammed them onto the end. You can check out your pew Bibles and you look up Mark 16 and you'll find that there's these other verses. They just slammed on these extra endings because they couldn't stand it. They had to give it some closure. All right. For years, we've tried to get rid of the disciples and the women's failure. We've tried to get rid of their fear. Maybe because we don't think it makes any sense, but then again, maybe because we just can't stand it. We can't stand their failure. It makes our skin crawl. It reminds us too much of us. It reminds us too much of us. And I think that's the point. I think that's the point. You see, in John's gospel, Jesus is standing right there next to the tomb, ripping and ready to greet Mary. And then he goes and starts showing up all over the place. He even makes a special appearance a second time to the disciples so that Thomas, you know, poor doubting Thomas, who wasn't there the first time, could stick his hand into Jesus' side. Jesus shows up all over the place. And then in Luke, what do we get but this wonderful little story about these two disciples going down to Emmaus, all right? And up comes Jesus just kind of like walking up next to him, and he starts telling them why it's necessary that the Messiah had to suffer and die and then rise from the dead. It's good stuff. And then there's Matthew's version. In Matthew's gospel, the women don't, they don't leave Jesus' tomb paralyzed with fear at all like in Mark. Instead, they leave, Matthew tells us, with great joy. And then what do? They go at once, immediately to the disciples, right away. Good for them. They figured it out. They listened. And we quickly find out that Jesus actually does meet them in Galilee. And that's where we get the famous Great Commission. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations. These are scenes of triumph, scenes of success. They're the stuff of Easter Sunday. We should have read that, but we read Mark. And in Mark, we get none of that. Instead, all we get is fear and failure. Failure to understand the meaning of Jesus' death. Failure to trust that Jesus knew what he was talking about. Failure even to believe that the tomb was really empty and the messenger of God who's sitting there explaining things as clear as day is telling the truth. Failure. Fear and failure. It's as if Mark is just so nervous that we'll get... It's as if he's so nervous that we'll forget about Good Friday and all the triumph of Easter Sunday that he can't bear it to just let us have our Jesus easy. We've got to follow him to Galilee first, he says. But really? Isn't he right? Isn't Mark right? Last week, Lucas Martin, for those of you who remember, Lucas Martin told the kids a story about a king who wanted to get married, but he was afraid that anybody who would agree to marry him would marry him because he was a king, because, you know, he was rich. So he dresses up like a peasant. And he starts to date a girl, and they fall in love. And at their wedding, he rips off his clothes and shows, "Look, I'm a king. Yay, you can marry me for love. This is fantastic." Luke's point, though, if you remember, was that Jesus isn't like that king at all. Not at all. Jesus doesn't become human just so that he can one day slough it all off. When Jesus washes the disciples' feet and teaches them what it means to serve and to love, when he suffers and dies all the way up to the cross, bleeding and suffocating to death, he's not wearing somebody else's clothes. He's not doing all this stuff, loving and serving all the way to the cross. He's not doing all this stuff just so that he can get something out of it, as if he's ruled by an ulterior motive or something like this. The suffering love, this unending service, that's what it means to be king. That's what it means to be God. And for Mark, the disciples just flat out missed it. They simply don't get it. Maybe they couldn't get it even, at least not yet. Jesus tells them that he's got to suffer and die, but one day, 3 days later, he's going to rise again. And Peter, right in response to that, Peter, the chief of the disciples, rebukes Jesus for saying that. Rebukes him. Peter doesn't get it. Suffering and death aren't part of Peter's game plan, but Jesus couldn't disagree more. He says suffering and death are central. If anyone wishes to come after me, you must deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow. Where? All the way to Galilee. But nobody does. None do. And that's the story of Mark. Why? Because in Mark, failure is where resurrection happens. Failure is where resurrection begins. The triumph of the resurrection, the triumph of Easter, the triumph of today, it's first and foremost the triumph of God. It's not ours. It's not our triumph, and that's Mark's point. The triumph of the resurrection is the triumph of God, even when all we have is fear. Even, if not especially, when all we do is fail. Only after God raises us up over and over and over again, only after God raises us up can we follow him to Galilee. After all, think about it. Isn't that what we see in Peter, the great denier? 3 times you'll deny me before the cock crows twice. Peter's the one who rebukes Jesus. Right after Peter called him the Messiah, by the way, he rebukes him. Peter doesn't get it. He fails. He's afraid. Weren't you with Jesus? No, that wasn't me. And yet it's Peter. Peter explicitly that the women are supposed to go tell. Don't be amazed. Don't be amazed. Jesus is risen. He's not here. He's gone before you into Galilee. Will you follow? If you need a resurrection appearance in Mark, it's right there. There's your resurrection appearance. Right there. Right there in Peter, the king of failure, the king of fear. Go tell the disciples, especially Peter. Raise him up. Raise him up. For Mark, failure is life. And that means if resurrection is going to happen, then it's up to God to do it. For me, that's the dose of reality that I need. How many times do we wake up in the morning and it looks nothing like Easter Sunday? All around us, we wake up and it looks like Good Friday. Fear and failure. Our fear. Our failure. We're just like the disciples. We're just like Peter. We're just like the women, silent and afraid, because so much of Jesus' way looks nothing like life to us. So much of Jesus' way leads right back to the cross. But we're still here. We're still here, stumbling our way toward Galilee, often failing, often trembling, fearful and afraid, and always, always looking for resurrection, the triumph of God. Amen.